Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the kickoff event for Silicon Valley Reads 2010, presented by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, the Santa Clara Library, the San Jose Public Library Foundation, and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Frederick Ferrer, and I'm the CEO of the Health Trust. It is now my pleasure and honor to introduce Michael Pollan, author of this year's Silicon Valley Reads selection, In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto. Michael has been successfully writing books and articles about the interaction of human and natural world for over 20 years. His previous book, Omnivore Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, was named one of the best books of 2006 by the New York Times and the Washington Post, and won the California Book Award, the Northern California Book Award, and the James Beard Award for Best Food Writing, and was one of the finalists for the National Book Critics Circle Award. One of Michael's other books, The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World, was also a New York Times bestseller, as well as a special two-hour documentary broadcast on PBS last fall. Michael currently resides in the Bay Area, and in 2003 was appointed the Knight Professor of Journalism at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, and the director of the Knight Program in Science and Environmental Journalism. Moderating tonight's conversation is Mike Cassidy, columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Michael Pollan and Mike Cassidy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's very kind.
Thanks.
Hello, Michael.
Well, listen, before we get started, Michael, I just wanted to explain that I was at work a little bit late, got kind of a late start, missed my dinner. So I
hit too.
Well, I hit the drive up on the way over. I ate mine in the car, but
what'd you bring?
I didn't want to be rude, so I do. I have a little something from you, for you.
Oh, that is so thoughtful.
And it's from the dollar menu. And
isn't that incredible? You can get this for a dollar?
95 cents, but then they put tax on it.
Uh-huh.
I thought that might keep the odor down. But I asked them to hit it with a little extra omega 3. But
you're too kind.
Seriously, we thought we'd pick a night to do this when not much was going on. There's the start of Davos, and Steve Jobs had his announcement up the road, whatever that was all about. And then, of course, there's the President's State of the Union address. But we're just glad you're here. We really are. It should be a great night, and I think we've got three great months of Silicon Valley Reads events coming up. So
before you start, I just want to say thank you to Health Trust and to the libraries for sponsoring this event. I mean, I'm always, whenever I can participate in one of these community reads, I just think it's such a useful kind of democratic discourse. Mm-hmm. I mean, that you get a whole community or chunk of it reading the same book, able to talk about it. And, you know, reading can be very isolating, and these kind of things bring people together to advance this conversation. And as you'll see, I don't have all the answers, but when you guys start asking the questions and answering them among yourselves, that's, you know, that's a big part of the process. So I'm very pleased to be part of this.
Okay, I think that's great. And as a matter of fact, I've said before, I think writing can be kind of an isolating process until you run into your editor, and then you wish it were an isolating process again. But I thought we might even congratulate Michael on yet another fine book that he's written. Maybe start with a little of that.
Thank you.
And so, of course, I've read the book, and I haven't eaten in about 2 weeks. And I actually haven't slept either because, you know, I'm...
Like, and you're looking good, very svelte.
Well, you should have seen me before, but I'm responsible for global warming. My kids are spending too much time in front of screens, and now I'm not eating right and not even close. I mean, I'm way off. And I'm wondering, what possessed you to write this book?
Now, which book are you talking about?
Well, we're defending food this evening.
Okay, all right.
We'll get around to the plug a little later on.
That's fine. Well, what possessed me to write this book was really readers asking me a question. I mean, the book before was The Omnivore's Dilemma, which is much more a book about the ethics of eating and the ecology of eating. And I spent 3 years trying to answer this, you know, what I thought would be a very simple question, which is, well, where does our food come from? Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be an elaborate answer in a long book. It's 300 or 400 pages. And I got to the bottom of that question, but a lot of readers were left with another question, which is, okay, now that you've told me about the feedlots and you've told me how they make the processed food and about all the high fructose corn syrup, but you didn't tell me what should I eat? And I was kind of, I was kind of leaving it for your imagination, you know. But I realized that, I hadn't dealt that much with the health question.
Right.
And finally, that is, for most people, the most compelling question.
Yeah.
As much as we're interested in the environment and the ethics of eating animals and all these other kinds of issues, finally people are left with, I'm very confused about food. With good reason. I mean, mm-hmm. to walk through the supermarket today is a very confusing experience.
So it's not just me.
It's not just you. Okay. No. And, you know, when this stuff only costs $1
yeah.
and a pear, you know, can cost more, that's confusing too.
Right, right. Well, you talked about it a little bit, but what got you started down this path? I mean, you've been writing about food and nutrition and not food for a long time.
Well, it was never my plan to write a book about food. I mean, when I set out. But, of course, I didn't have much of a plan at all.
Yeah.
I was a magazine editor when I started writing. I was at Harper's Magazine for many years. And really learned to write when I was there, working as an editor on other people's work.
Huh.
And I got started. Well, I mean, the story doesn't seem like it has to do with food, but it does. I got started writing about food because I started gardening.
Uh-huh.
And I was very pleased to hear that Health Trust is kind of pushing this idea that a key to improving health and dealing with obesity is gardening, which is absolutely true. Gardening is a very powerful activity in many, many ways. And I always liked to garden. I had a vegetable garden when I was 8 years old. Huh. I had a grandfather who was a terrific gardener on the South Shore of Long Island. I didn't study any of this stuff in school. I studied English in school, and I loved Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Walt Whitman, and these are the people I read.
Right.
The reason I bring that up is that when I came into the garden as a writer, I brought their ideas about nature with me. And those were that, you know, nature is wonderful and, you know, we're part of nature and there is no reason to alienate ourselves from nature. And then I woke up one morning and these woodchucks had, like, devastated my garden.
Yeah.
And I didn't even have a fence because Thoreau had taught me that was very... you know, alienating from nature. And you know, we have this wonderful wilderness tradition in American literature, and it has done great things. It is the reason we have Yosemite. It is the reason we have Yellowstone. And as
it's the reason we have woodchucks.
And it's the reason we have too many woodchucks. And as, you know, as powerful an idea as that is, and as useful it is for preserving nature, it's not very useful, as I found, for engaging with nature, which we have to do. And we have to do in order to feed ourselves. We have to do in order to get energy. We have to, you know, given that we happen to live on all these, you know, 6 of the 7 continents, we need to, we change nature. And so how do you do that well? Mm-hmm. And so I got interested, and I realized then, and I had this, I got into this war with this woodchuck. It was kind of, I tell the story in second nature. I'm not proud of it. For people who think of me as an environmental writer, you would be amazed what I did. You know, I ended up firebombing a woodchuck burrow, and which didn't work. And but I was kind of in the process of going through this ordeal, and almost, you know, destroying my garden. I realized that the garden was a really good place to explore our relationship to nature, because in the garden you have to change things. And it's a microcosm of agriculture. It's a microcosm of a lot of things, you know, the middle landscape, the built landscape. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to write a book all about what I learned about how to deal with nature being a gardener. And that was Second Nature, my first book. And I realized my subject as a writer was that messy area between nature and culture, and that I like to do that more than going to the woods. I think of myself as kind of a nature writer who doesn't like to go camping.
The myth of the happy camper.
Yeah, I'm not a very happy camper. Yeah. So, if that's your subject, if you're really interested in this, is in the friction between the natural and the natural world and culture, human culture, sooner or later you're going to get to food.
Right.
I didn't know
right.
this at the time, but of course you have to deal with food, because agriculture is how we change nature more than anything else we do. It's happening on your plate. The composition of species, the look of the landscape, and now we know even the climate is more affected by our eating choices than anything else. So I came into it through nature and through the garden.
Okay.
Long answer to should be an easy question. But it was never my plan, and it certainly wasn't my plan to write three books on food.
Yeah, that's a trilogy, I guess.
Yeah.
So what do you eat?
Well, not a lot of this.
Yeah.
I have to say, I was hoping you were saying, you know, this was from In-N-Out Burger, or it was grass-fed burger.
Next time I'll know.
You know, I eat all sorts of things. I probably eat more different things than people would imagine. I tend not to eat processed food. I don't eat feedlot meat. But I eat meat. I'm a carnivore.
Uh-huh.
I eat, you know, I'm picky about meat. I eat grass-fed meat. I eat, you know, pastured chickens. I eat, you know, eat the meat that they sell at the farmer's market.
Yeah.
What else? I mean, God, name it. I eat it. I don't eat Twinkies.
Right. You have one in your office, though, right?
I have one in my office. Yeah.
I thought you
forgot
could
to bring
this
it.
Next to it, maybe. See which one spoils first.
Well, the Twinkie, as you know, lasted now. It's going on 3 years.
All right. Well, it wouldn't last that long in our house. But well, do you get tired of people asking you what you eat?
No.
Okay, you can nod.
Yeah, no,
it's
I mean,
radio.
It changes. I mean, I try to think when I'm eating, like, okay, this is what I eat. It's like normal food.
Yeah.
You know, I had eggs for breakfast and toast. And lunch today, I was at Saul's, which is a deli in Berkeley, and they had they have grass-fed beef,
wow,
roast beef. So, I feel, having inspired them to get it, that I have to eat it now.
Right. That's
and
fair
so
enough.
Even though I didn't want it, I had a half of a roast beef sandwich and a little bowl of matzo ball soup. And dinner remains to be seen.
I'm starting to get hungry. Well, you're ahead of me.
I love to eat.
You can remember what you had for breakfast.
I can, usually, because I get asked more than you do, probably.
Probably. And I think I read you have a, I guess, would be a teenage son now.
Yeah, I have a 17-year-old, yeah.
And how was that, you know, particularly when he was growing up?
Well, it was a real challenge. And he's another reason. His name is Isaac. And he's another reason that I got interested in food, because he was an atrocious eater. From about age 3 till 15.
Yeah.
A long time.
Yeah.
And he was one of these white food eaters.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he would only eat the blandest food imaginable. And we had to make him different food. He wouldn't eat normal food.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he was incredibly picky. He's a super taster. I'm convinced. I mean, you can test this. We haven't tested it yet. But his taste buds are so sensitive. And his sense of smell is so powerful that, you know, well, when we traveled, we'd bring his brand of pasta with us.
Right, okay.
Because he wouldn't eat anything in a hotel or anything.
Uh-huh.
And we'd make him his Barilla noodles, but he wouldn't eat them. And we said, why? It tastes different. You know, the water's different.
Oh, gosh.
Oh,
wow.
Shit.
Wow.
Oops. Sorry. We're on the radio. So he was
It's understandable.
He was very hard to feed. And I watched him struggle with it because he didn't want to be this way.
Right, right.
Because it kept him from going to friends' houses and sleeping over and all these kind of things because he wouldn't eat. And he had this powerful kind of gag reflex almost if he tried to eat something new. And I learned a lot about our food instincts. I mean, we do have this, you know, we have a neophilia, a love of the new, and we have a neophobia, a fear of the new.
Right.
And to be a successful omnivore, you need both, actually. You need to be willing to try things because you're living in new places, you're migrating around the world. But if you're so open to the new, you're going to eat some poison mushroom and die.
Right.
So we're always on that spectrum. And he was way over on the neophobic side. But that's all changed.
That's interesting. What changed that?
Well, I'm not sure exactly, but he kind of discovered food about 2 years ago, and it was and his sensitivities turned, instead of being an impediment to eating, they became an inducement.
Right.
And he, part of what I think turned him around, I mean, some of it is probably just maturation and curiosity, but he got very interested in cooking.
Okay.
And we got him very involved in cooking. Mm-hmm. And kids who cook will try things that they wouldn't try under any other circumstances.
Right.
Because instead of having that mysterious sauce covering up who knows what, you know, they've seen that this is made out of, we're not sneaking anything by them.
Right.
And they also, the other place I learned that he would eat is in the garden. And that's another powerful fact about gardens. Kids will eat vegetables in the garden that they pick themselves that they will not eat anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
Because they're so fresh and because they feel invested having picked it themselves and perhaps having helped grow it. So we garden and we cook a lot. And it was through that that he got interested. And then he took a job in a restaurant. He worked as as an intern at Chez Panisse. And,
interesting.
I know,
wow,
pretty good deal, right? And he worked there 2 summers in a row, a full shift from like 2 in the afternoon to 11 at night, and he worked really hard, and it's not glamorous. I mean, he came home one day, he said, I spent 5 hours pitting cherries and, you know, doing stuff like that. And but what they do there, it's a very, very civilized place to work. At 8 o'clock, the kitchen crew between seatings downstairs goes out to a picnic table in the back, and they eat that night's meal.
Oh, that's nice.
And they pour wine, and
I'm applying next summer.
Yeah, and his, you know, all these kind of young hip chefs in their 20s would bug him to try things. You have to try this quail. You have to try this squab. You have to try this, you know, whatever. And he the peer pressure. It wasn't us. It was someone else who he respected telling him to try this.
Exactly.
He tried it, and he discovered all these foods. And I knew he turned the corner. He came home one day. He would bike up the hill from the restaurant. And I said, how was dinner? And he said, it was good. We had quail. And I said, how do you like it? And he says, I much prefer squab. Like, okay.
Well, that's
and now he's
progress.
Impossible to feed because he's so picky about the quality. It's got to be really good.
Look what you've done, or Chez Panisse has done, I guess. So, speaking of Chez Panisse, did you hear they're making pork chops out of stem cells in Europe?
I know they're trying to make meat out of their clone. They basically want to figure out a way to make meat without making the animal.
Yeah.
And they figured out a way to clone muscle cells. Although, if you've ever eaten meat, you know there's more going on than muscle cells.
Yeah.
There's also fat cells. And they're in a very pleasing arrangement. And so, you know, call me when they really nail it down.
All right.
A lot of animal rights people feel this is the solution. That if we eat in vitro meat, as it's called.
They're going to have to come up with a different name, I think.
Yeah. But, you know, look, I mean, food science is capable of amazing things.
Yeah.
You know, does that get you off the ethical hook? I mean, maybe it'll be environmentally friendlier than eating beef, which has a big carbon footprint.
Yeah.
But in general, you know, this whole the whole direction of food science for the last 40 years has been kind of moving toward the ultimate meal in a pill.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of remove food from nature as much as you can. Mm-hmm. There's something attractive mm-hmm. about that dream. But there's also something kind of turn-off about that dream.
Yeah.
And so if you think about it, we're moving in the opposite direction. I mean, a lot of people are toward heirloom, varieties, right. traditional varieties of meat. And I don't think people really like that idea of food. So I can't imagine it catching on.
Yeah, it does seem
Peter
hard.
Singer will eat that stuff. And Jonathan Safran Foer, but I don't know who else.
It's a little hard to fathom. Well, they may have a reality show about it or something. But I've been going to the same doctor, I think, for about 20 years. And his only dietary advice to me is, you should lose 2 pounds every month. And I said, well...
You know where that leads.
Yeah, I said, hey, wait a minute, doc. You know, eventually there won't be any of me. And he said, you know, I really don't think you have to worry about that. Just lose 2 pounds a month. But we get along okay. But he's never... really talk to me about the Western diet or alternatives to the Western diet. And
so he doesn't propose how you're going to do this?
Well, it's a long story. Uh-huh. Did send me to a nutritionist, and I learned that tuna fish salad isn't health food, but I learned a few other things.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't think he's... I think he's well-meaning. I don't think he's necessarily in the pocket of Big Ag or anything else. I mean, why aren't doctors out there more talking about
this
kind of
stuff? Well, next time you see your doctor, ask him about how much training in nutrition he had in medical school.
Okay.
You will be amazed. He will tell you it's a couple of hours. It's not, you know, in many medical schools, it's not even a whole course.
Huh.
I remember Andrew Weil, who went to Harvard Medical School, telling me that he had like one 90-minute lecture in nutrition, and that's all he got at Harvard Medical School. So doctors do not get a lot of training in nutrition, and I think it's a big problem. And they look at, or the medical establishment looks at nutrition as something for dietitians. It's kind of a second-class, subject. And so that's a big part of the problem. Another problem is... that doctors don't have time to talk about nutrition.
Right.
And then a third part is the economics of the profession. I mean, there's a lot more money to be made in pharmaceuticals, bariatric surgery, and we've medicalized these problems.
Yeah.
And we, you know, diabetes is a class, type 2 diabetes is a classic example. There is a huge industry around type 2 diabetes. Many, many people get rich off of it.
Yeah.
And prevention is not economical in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can imagine a healthcare system where it would become very economical, but in general it's not. So I think that doctors could do a whole lot more because they have a lot of cultural authority, and I think if they talked about it. You know, I got a very interesting letter from a doctor recently, or an email, and I had made the solicitation for food rules for this new book that I just published.
Right.
And he had written one in, and he said, I'm a transplant cardiologist, and when I look into the chest cavities of these patients I'm working on, I am so depressed by what the diet is doing to people. And I know when I close them up that they're going to go on and do it again.
Right.
And I'm giving them a new heart. And then they're going out and... eating this. And he said, so at my last appointment with them, I give them a recipe for roast chicken.
Huh.
And I explain to them, with this one recipe, you can have 3 meals. You know, you roast it right. one day, and he tells you just how to do it. It's a simple recipe, huh. you know, what temperature to put it in, how to tell when it's done. Then you take, so you eat half of it, and the other half becomes the meal for the next night, and you make, tacos with chicken or whatever it is. And then on the third night, you make a soup from the carcass. And that this was his gift. You know, these are people
That's
expecting
great.
To leave with prescriptions. And he's giving them a recipe. I think it's such a beautiful idea. So if more doctors thought that way.
Yeah, yeah. The guy's
and
would
talk about roast chicken rather than Lipitor.
Right.
I think we would be much better off.
Well, I was going to say his office is going to be stormed by pharmaceutical salespeople tomorrow. But there was, you know, you were talking about diabetes, and there was a part in Defense of Food that I thought was just great. Of course, I can't say it as well as you wrote it, but the idea that it's much easier to make a disease into a lifestyle than to eliminate the disease or create a lifestyle that would prevent the disease. And that just really struck me.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, capitalism is a wondrous thing, and it's incredibly inventive and powerful. Whenever the system creates a problem, that problem becomes an opportunity.
Yeah.
So very seldom does capitalism like to go back to the beginning and fix what caused the problem. Better, you know, whole new opportunity.
Yeah.
And I've seen this throughout, you know, looking at the food system. You know, food safety in meat. I mean, we have this, you know, tremendous problem. We just had a huge recall of hamburger because of E. coli 015787 last week. And the industry, you know, it's not hard to prevent. If you slow down the slaughterhouses so they're not slaughtering 400 head an hour, mm-hmm. if you put the animals on grass or hay for the last week of their life, if you give them some space and take care of their health and slaughter the meat with care, you're not going to have this problem. But that's not how the system works. The system is much more interested in coming up with a technology to zap it. So, you know, new acid baths for the carcasses or radiation, which the industry's, you know, so you create a whole new business to solve the problem. And we're just kind of chasing our tail with this. And we seldom look at things systemically and try to, well, could we go back and make this fix?
Mm-hmm.
It never seems to happen.
Well, and you'll be happy to know, I mean, the book's really got me thinking, and beyond those powerful economic forces that you wrote about, I'm, you know, watching TV because, like, my kids watch too much TV, so I got to see what they're watching, right? So otherwise I would be off reading and hiking.
Right.
But, you know, you see what Taco Bell's got an ad for the fourth meal.
Yeah.
So, like, three
brilliant?
Aren't enough. You got to have the fourth meal, which I think you have at 2 in the morning or something.
Yeah, it's really late at night. It's a really good time for a big meal, yeah.
And then there's the round-headed jack-in-the-box guy talking about how much grub you can get at his place for hardly any money.
$3.49 now. You know what you can get there for $3.49?
I don't.
You can get I watch these ads, too. You can get a hamburger, French fries, and soda, okay, and two tacos.
Wow. And you could have it three times a day for like $12.
Yeah. It's, you know, so you understand why, you know, we've made it the rational thing to eat that way rather than to cook. Or I mean, you can't cook a meal for $3.49. It's astounding. I don't know how they do that. I can't imagine they make
That's
money on that
meal.
That's
actually a good question. Yeah. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the meat lover's breakfast at Denny's.
Yeah.
But
oh, don't want to miss that.
But the other thing that was eye opening to me, and I hate to sound dim, but so there are all these human health problems, your own personal health, but the way we're eating is also really unhealthy for the environment. We're basically screwing up the whole planet besides clogging our arteries and such.
Yeah, I mean, the same Western diet that is such a problem for our health and is contributing to so much chronic disease. Look, I mean, this is what kills us, is diseases linked to diet in the West. Takes a huge toll on the environment. And the reason for that is, well, you don't have to look any further than meat. A key feature of the Western diet is huge amounts, unprecedented amounts of meat in the American diet, 200 pounds per person per year. 9 ounces a day, okay? And a lot of people are eating a lot more than that because they have to make up for the vegetarians.
Yeah, that's right.
And so what's the carbon footprint of all that meat? Well, it's tremendous. If you're a meat eater, it's a quarter of your carbon footprint. Now, how does that work? Well, animal agriculture, it takes 10 pounds of grain to get 1 pound of beef. Uh-huh. To grow all that grain takes lots of fossil fuel, for the fertilizer, for the cornfields, for the pesticide for the cornfields, for the drying of the corn, the processing of the corn. And then you have the animals themselves who emit huge amounts of methane,
right,
which is a much more serious greenhouse gas than carbon. And the fertilizers on the field to grow the feed emit nitrous oxide, also worse than... is it nitrous oxide? Yeah. Also worse than carbon dioxide. So meat by itself has a really big carbon footprint. And if you could reduce your meat consumption, not stop it, but reduce your meat consumption by 20%, that would be the equivalent of trading in a gas-guzzling sedan for a
wow.
Prius. Okay? It's you know, the most important contributor.
And I still get like 160 pounds of meat, right?
So yeah, that's right.
It's not horrible.
It's not a big sacrifice.
That's interesting.
If we had a meatless Monday in this country, which yeah. some people are, there's the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins has this campaign for a meatless Monday, which, you know, that's a
yeah,
pretty doable thing, right? Can you imagine one day without meat? It would be the equivalent of taking 40 million cars off the road.
Wow.
So we can gain a lot by this. And finally, you're seeing some attention to it. Al Gore, who never talked about
right.
meat or food in Inconvenient Truth, in his most recent book, he has a chapter about agriculture and climate change where he talks about these ideas. And it's really encouraging that that conversation has begun.
So given what I've read about politicians and talking about food policy and specific foods, sounds like he's not running again, huh?
Yeah, no, that's proof, yeah.
Yeah. So I promised a plug for Michael Pollan's latest book, and it's called Food Rules. And as you were working on that, I take it you solicited from New York Times readers and others, I suppose.
Oh, and all sorts of, yeah, and audiences when I was speaking, yeah. Just
Their rules, right? You got, what, 2,500 responses or something?
Yeah, that was in 2 days in the New York Times. It was amazing.
Wow. A lot of people must read that paper.
Actually, it wasn't. It was in the blog.
Oh, okay.
They read the blog.
What's that?
I'll tell you about it later.
Okay.
It's this wonderful new way to
It'll never
go
last.
Broke
never
writing.
Last. Yeah, that's for sure. What were some of the more memorable or even humorous suggestions you got?
Well, there were a lot of really offbeat ones that I couldn't understand the logic between, but I think my favorite was one meat per pizza. That if you could really hold it to just the meatballs, you'd be fine. What else? Don't eat anything bigger than your head.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
Which,
certainly
you know,
not
you
at one
think
sitting.
About a watermelon. I mean, you know, you could eat all the watermelon you want. I don't think that would be a problem.
That's true.
And it's much bigger
it's
than
a starting
head.
Point.
It's a starting point. But, I mean, it's, you know, there are a lot of interesting rules. And actually, I got a bunch, which is a portion of animal protein should be no bigger than what you could hold in one hand.
Okay.
Which is an interesting... And a full portion of food should be no bigger than... A meal should be no bigger than what you can have in your hand, in both hands, cupped together. So that was interesting. The reason I did it was that it's my conviction that there is a lot of wisdom about food that's out there.
Right.
That kind of predates modern food marketing, predates this endless, useless nutrition conversation that we have over, you know, fats and carbohydrates and nutrients of all kinds. And that before science stepped forward to tell us what to eat with, I think, a misplaced confidence, we had culture.
Yeah.
And culture, you know, guided people, both in terms of what to eat and what not to eat and the amounts to eat and the manners that surround food. And that culture is where we culture of food is really where we have a deficit right now, and we have too much science and not enough culture. And until the science gets better, until they really nail down what is wrong with that Western diet
mm-hmm.
that leads to all that chronic disease, because we do know that. I mean, the big thing we know is that this Western diet we've been eating since the turn of the last century, approximately. But in an intensified way since World War II, populations who eat that diet get very high rates of cardiovascular disease, heart disease and stroke, type 2 diabetes, obesity, and about 30 to 40% of cancers, all linked to that diet. That's not contested. What is contested, and what all the arguments you read are about, is like, is it the carbohydrates that's doing that, the refined mm-hmm. carbohydrates, or is it the saturated fat, which is what we believe for a long time, or is it the lack of fiber? And that's what people argue about. And they'll figure it out eventually, perhaps,
right.
Although it may not be one nutrient. It may be a synergy between several nutrients. But we know all we need to know to act, which is that diet is the problem, and to the extent we can get off it. And I should define it, I guess, quickly, which is a Western diet is a diet with lots of meat and processed food, lots of added fat and sugar, and lots of calories, but very little fruits, vegetables and whole grains. That way of eating. Mm-hmm. We know all we need to know. The challenge is, how do you get off it?
Yeah, yeah. It's
and that, so that's what these rules are about. They're kind of ways to get off it without, you know, having to go back to the bush.
Right,
or
right.
Or the jungle.
Yeah. Well, actually, that section, that was kind of a bright spot for me in the book, where I learned that, you know, if need be, we can survive on chocolate and hot dogs. I'm thinking, you know, throw in pizza and beer, and you got the four food groups right there.
You know?
But seriously, I love the discussion of culture and food, because I have a lot of little things which we won't go into how successful they are, but at home, you know, I don't, you know, let's not eat standing up. You know, let's sit down together as a family and
eat.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
You know, I won't allow the milk jug on the table, which I just get unmitigated grief for.
Uh-huh. What's the thinking behind that one?
It actually is a...
An aesthetic?
My grandmother said it would cause divorce.
But, really?
Yeah. But I thought it might sound good, because it is a little, you know, one of those plastic jugs,
yeah,
which, you know, is another... On my list of sins, we get the plastic jug of milk,
right,
low fat. But anyway, but you know, so it occurs to me, people spend thousands of dollars and fly halfway across the world to go to France and Italy, and part of the experience is the food and the way people eat there and sit around and talk, you know. And
why don't we do it here? It's so interesting, and that's what, yeah, when people go, especially when they go to Europe or Japan, that's what they're so taken with, and that's one of the great pleasures is that way of eating and that way of approaching mealtime. And but Americans have, I think, always had trouble taking pleasure in food.
Uh-huh.
And we've always rushed it. I mean, you read these 19th century accounts of eating in America. You know, Dickens wrote one, and all the novelists would come here and the other writers, and they would just be, like, scandalized by how we eat. And we would just, like, gobble our food and run. Uh-huh. And we were just too busy.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think it's a Puritan inheritance. I mean, that, you know, we have trouble taking pleasure in doing things that animals also do.
Uh-huh.
And I think this is just an American thing, and so that it seems very effete or foppish to take pleasure in food.
Uh-huh.
And I mentioned, I think, in that book about there was a presidential election. It was William Henry Harrison and somebody else, and the sitting president, who did Harrison run against? Anybody know? I don't remember. Had hired a French chef in the White House, and he got no end of grief for it. And the guy running against him was a real, you know, tough mountain,
right,
man, who claimed he lived on nothing but raw beef and salt.
Wow.
And he got elected. And you remember Clinton boasting about eating fast,
right,
food,
right,
and that he was a junk food junkie, and the first Bush with his fried pork rinds. And Obama, who there actually eats really well,
yeah,
makes a very public point about going out to some greasy spoon for cheeseburgers,
exactly,
every now and then, because he understands the politics of arugula.
Right,
and
right.
He doesn't want to go there.
Don't get near this stuff. That's
no.
Right. Yeah. No.
Actually, they do have it in the garden. I thought that was pretty impressive that they did. They were willing to take the chance.
It's probably a nice garden, yeah. But I can't tell you how many people in recent weeks have said, you know, oh, you get to talk to Michael Pollan? You know, oh, my gosh. You know, it's like you're like a rock star. I mean, I've told several friends I would leave them tickets. I didn't tell them it was a free event. I just told them I'd leave them tickets.
That trick.
But, I mean, what's that like? I mean, what has writing these books, how has that changed your life?
It's a totally weird experience. I mean, you know, you're a journalist. You prize your, you know, status as an observer and being able to have a certain amount of anonymity. And it's very strange to be the, you know, the story, and very uncomfortable, actually, in a lot of ways. And it's very hard to go out and do interviews with people. And
right, right.
Partly because they know where you're coming from. And they
sure don't want to go to lunch with you.
And so anyway, it's a totally, you know, and there is a certain self-consciousness in restaurants,
yeah,
and so it's, look, it's, you know, it's a very freaky thing.
Well,
but it won't last.
There is that.
Yeah, this culture is, you know, very fickle, and it'll move on.
Well, I heard what is probably an apocryphal Michael Pollan story about the Berkeley Bowl, which I'm sure
no,
you've
heard.
No,
it's not apocryphal. But
really? But I probably have the wrong product, but it was something like you had put Fruit Loops in your cart or something like that.
Yeah.
And you were either accosted or, you know, not physically, but somebody was berating you about that or certainly
yeah,
brought it up.
This was actually, even before I published Omnivore's Dilemma, I was shopping in Berkeley Bowl, where we do our shopping, and my son had a weekend cereal that it wasn't Fruit Loops. It was, I mean, it was nothing better than Fruit Loops. It might as well
There's
have been
nothing
Fruit
better
Loops.
Than Fruit Loops.
And I had it. I put it in the cart, and someone tapped on my shoulder and said, "I'm watching Michael Pollan shop for groceries." Ooh. And, you know, there was the organic brown rice, too, but, you know, that wasn't as noticeable as the Fruit Loops. It was like, I stayed out of there for a very long time. I mean, you know, Berkeley, everybody's in everybody's business.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very judgmental culture.
Well, remember when we were trying to reform healthcare, like a couple weeks ago?
I think that was last week, right?
Was that, yeah.
Before last Tuesday.
Those were the days.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, you know, what role abandoning this Western diet could have in, you know, in our healthcare system, what it might mean.
Oh, it has tremendous potential to save money, save lives. Look, we spend, what is it, $2.3 trillion on treating diseases in this country. A huge amount of money. Three-quarters of that, according to the Centers for Disease Control, are preventable chronic diseases. Now, not all of that is food-related. You've got alcoholism, you've got smoking, you've got a couple other things in there. But most of it is. So that if we really were to deal in a serious way with the American diet and persuaded people to change and created the incentives that would allow them to change by making healthy food a better deal than this stuff. I'm pointing to the burger for the people in the radio audience.
Cheeseburger,
McDonald's. We would save enormous amounts of money and more important, suffering.
Yeah.
And I think this is understood, but it's considered to be too hard and also politically a little risky.
Yeah.
People don't want to be told what to eat.
Right.
Especially by politicians. And, you know, even Jamie Oliver, with all his kind of working class cred, you know, he was reforming school lunch in England, and he got so much grief from parents who just resented the implicit criticism of the way they were bringing up their kids, that right. they would come to the schoolyards throwing bags of chips over the fence at their kids and sodas. And it's very interesting how much people feel that that's nobody's business
right.
to you know, instruct or advise about food, yet they will happily sit for any medical procedure and do anything their doctor tells them if it involves taking a pill or putting a stent in their heart or you know, any number of other things.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure, just do it to me. And it's a very peculiar thing. So yeah. I think it's very hard politically to deal with.
Yeah.
But I think that the key is to change the incentives so people do it on their own. And there are a lot of people who want to eat better food and can't afford to. And that has to do with the way we subsidize agriculture. I mean, we basically, you know, this hamburger gets many kinds of support from the government. I mean, it starts with the feed for the cattle, which is heavily subsidized to the tune of $4 or $5 billion a year just for the corn subsidies. And then you've got the feedlots where the meat is raised, which those feedlots are essentially exempted from clean air and clean water laws because they're farms,
right.
so-called.
Yeah.
And then you've got the antibiotics that you must give the animals to keep them alive in feedlots, which is, you know, a public good that we're squandering on these feedlots. And the government, you know, allows them to use antibiotics in this way. The government, which regulates drugs and decides which drugs can be used by which people.
Right.
And then the third, antibiotics. Well, those are the three big ones. Uh-huh. So that's the struts on which this cheap burger sits.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's how they sell it for 95 cents.
And that's how they can sell it that cheaply. And that's why it's rational to eat badly. So you can change those incentives, but it's going to take some action at the federal level.
Well, I think this is sort of what we're talking about here is, you know, when I read your solutions or suggestions, which I was very happy to get to that part of the book because I was starting to get anxious, like, oh, my God, you know, what are we going to do? A lot of them seem to have to do with either spending more time or more money on food or with food. And so what do you say to people who literally can't afford more money on food or who feel like they don't have, you know, another hour in the day or whatever? Do you have any advice there?
Well, I think that is a big challenge for people. I'm more sympathetic, I think, to the financial challenge some people face. But the fact is, I think, in order to eat a healthy meal, healthy diet, you do need to put in either more money or more time, and ideally some combination of the two. It's very unpopular to say we don't spend enough money on food, especially in a time of economic hardship.
Right.
But we do spend less than anybody on the face of this earth, less than anybody in the history of civilization, 9.5% of our income. In Europe, and that's not just because we have a high standard of living. In countries with a higher standard of living, such as Europe, they spend about 15%. And we feel entitled to having this really cheap food. Now, I think that the cheapness of food has actually underwritten the decline in wages in this country. So in other words,
makes sense.
The rise of fast food begins in the 1970s at the same time that wages are collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
And wages could collapse because people could still eat.
Right.
And so I think that we need to pay people well enough that they can afford real food.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is not just force down the price of food. The answer is give people more spending power. And this is why healthcare reform is really, really important. Has anyone seen Food Inc., the documentary? I guess it's being shown as part of this event, and I urge you to see it if you haven't. But there's a family in that film, the Orozcos of Baldwin Park, California, and the father, it's two girls, and the father is has type 2 diabetes. One of the daughters is pre-diabetic. They eat at Burger King almost every night.
Oh, wow.
They can feed the whole family for $14.
Right.
And there's a scene where they go into the supermarket, and the girls want to buy some pears. And the father says, well, how many can you get for a dollar? And it was like 1.5.
Right.
He says, sorry, we can't do that. And he explains he spends $150 a month on diabetes medicine.
Wow.
And so he has to weigh that choice. And the mother asked the camera at some point, so what should we do? Should we buy the pills or buy the pears? And, you know, no one should have to make that choice.
Right.
And, of course, in Europe, they don't have to make that choice.
Right.
The pills are covered. And so it's part of a larger systemic problem, and it has to do with the healthcare system, and it has to do with wages and the minimum wage. And, you know, that said, for I think we've convinced ourselves that it's incredibly time-consuming to cook.
Uh-huh.
You know, in the time it takes to microwave a frozen entree.
Yeah.
Right, which is a really long time. You can put some food on the table, real food, and we would just rather stand watching the microwave, the seconds count down, than to boil some water and make pasta.
Makes that nifty noise at the end.
But I think we've lost the skills of cooking too, and people are intimidated by the kitchen. A lot of people, some people don't even have the equipment. But that there are, if you're strategic about it. If you're willing to make three or four meals on a Sunday afternoon,
right.
you can eat very well for that week. You can make that roast chicken or that soup. And I've been looking at this question a lot, mm-hmm. and there are, some excellent things to eat. You know, you can eat, soups, amazing vegetable soups with fresh produce, are not that expensive to make. And that in a, you know, a good loaf of bread is a terrific meal. Mm-hmm. And also, if, you know, beans are an amazing source of protein. And I've had ecologists tell me that if Americans would eat a lot more beans, what it would do for the soil, because of the, you know, their legumes, and they actually help with the soil. If we had another bean in our agricultural rotation, and of course it's a source of protein that's, you know, very inexpensive. You can buy a pound of organic beans for less than $1. So there are ways to do it. People, you know, and this is, guess what? The history of mankind has been, clever peasant uses of what nature has to offer to turn it into really good food.
Right.
And we've lost a lot of those skills. And, of course, we're seduced by fast food.
Yeah.
And it is. It's very seductive.
We have, in Defense of Food, a really nice passage about your garden, which you were talking a bit about gardening, and then also the kitchen and how, I don't know if dynamic's the word, but how things change in the kitchen when you're working with food from your garden.
Yeah. Well, you know, cooking, the more I look at this question, cooking is a big part of the problem and perhaps the biggest part of the solution. And it really is the collapse of cooking over the last, you know, since the 1960s that has gotten us into a lot of trouble. What happens when you outsource your cooking to corporations is that you don't eat as well. And the reason for that is, I mean, there are a lot of reasons for that, but one is that they make money by keeping the raw ingredients as cheap as possible. Mm-hmm. And so it's not high quality food. And then they kind of amp it up with sugar, salt, and fat because we respond to those things.
Yeah.
David Kessler's book is, you know, really smart about this. And when you combine two of those three things, this is the book, The End of Overeating, we really respond. We're hardwired to like those flavors. And it so happens that they're the cheapest flavors or ingredients you can add to any kind of food. So why not? So they load up on those things, and the food ends up being really unhealthy. And the other thing that happens when you let corporations cook for you is that they can very efficiently and cheaply make things that, if you made them yourself, are an incredible pain.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of French fries.
Right.
You know, how often would you make French fries yourself? Not that often, because it's a lot of work, and you end up with a very messy kitchen and a big pot of oil that you don't know what to do with. But companies can make them really, really cheaply. So we end up eating this special occasion food every day.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons, I think, that that we're struggling with weight to the extent that we are.
Now, you're obviously not a politician, but do you ever get blowback, either, you know, an email or people wanting to pick fights with you? Or,
oh, yeah. Lately?
Yeah. I'm having
right now a lot of blowback from the industry. I've had about four speaking dates at agricultural schools or schools with big ag departments where I have had dealt with various forms of protest. Two weeks ago, I spoke at Washington State University, but the invitation had been canceled. They were doing a community read, and they had bought 4,000 copies of In Defense of Food or Omnivore's Dilemma for the student body. And then apparently some regent at the university who was a big wheat grower objected that I was coming to campus.
That's pretty intriguing.
And he leaned on them, and they canceled the event. And they said it was for budgetary reasons.
Generally speaking, that's true. But
well, generally speaking, it's true, but they had already bought. Yes, in that sense. They had already bought 4,000 books.
Yeah.
So what happened was, that was kind of interesting, a distinguished alum of this school is Bill Marler, who's the leading personal injury lawyer on food poisoning cases.
Okay.
And he's a pretty fierce critic of the meat industry. And he's the guy you go to when your kid has E. coli poisoning. Uh-huh. And all he has to do now is call them up and they write a big check. And so he said, well, I'll pay all the expenses if indeed it is about money. So he called their bluff, and then I went. And but now when I go to these things, there's a panel of, you know, with industry people attacking me afterwards that I have to endure. And then this happened at University of Wisconsin. This happened at Cal Poly. You know the Harris Ranch?
On, yeah. I think I can
Known
smell
to
it
its
from
neighbors
here.
As Kauschwitz.
Yeah.
Well, they got wind of the fact I had been invited to Cal Poly to speak down in San Luis Obispo, and they threatened, and this is all documented. The letters are out and on the web. You can see them yourself. They threatened to cancel a $500,000 gift to the university if they didn't have a debate. I mean, you know, bring on equal time as if, you know, I mean, I was the equal time for what the usual message is at a school like that. But and then they also threatened to remove the money if a professor they didn't like continued to teach a required course in animal science, a professor who was saying that cattle and sheep should be getting grass, not grain, in their diet. So the industry is fighting back now. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the ag schools, the industry doesn't really understand academic freedom very well, it appears,
from
this kind of behavior. So I went down there and participated in a debate. And I'm always happy to debate these issues. And I think it's a really important debate to have. And I like going to those schools because these are the places where we're going to reinvent our agriculture if we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And it's very important that the ag schools not be dominated by industry. I mean, that they have free exchange of ideas. Or we're, you know, it's going to be like, agriculture is going to be like the auto industry, you know.
Right.
Very well defended until it collapses.
Yeah. To talk a bit about another kind of farming, one of our audience members was wondering whether you could talk about the benefits and dangers of farmed fish.
I wish I knew more about it, but aquaculture is, I think, a really important industry going forward. I mean, learning how to do sustainable aquaculture is, I think, one of the most important things we have to figure out in the next 100 years. And have we figured it out yet? No. I mean, most aquaculture is not sustainable, usually because of the feed source that they use bycatch, so that they're basically, you know, just catching everything and turning it into fish meal to feed fish. So that if you eat a farmed salmon, you're actually eating, you know, I don't know how many pounds of fish. But there are ways to do it sustainably, and there are people working on it. And there are some examples of sustainably farmed salmon. There are some examples of sustainably farmed shrimp. But most shrimp is environmentally very destructive.
I've heard
most
that.
Of the, the, you know, I mean, isn't it weird how, remember how luxurious shrimp cocktail was?
Yeah.
Like your parents would never let you have shrimp cocktail. It had to be your birthday. Now you get giant bags of it for $4. Yeah. Well, how do they do that? Well, they do it by decimating the mangrove forests, and they do it by decimating the seas all over Asia. And it's a really kind of a slash and burn aquaculture.
You know, there was even shrimp at the Mercury News over the holidays. So then
so you know how cheap it is.
Really cheap. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
But there are... But we have figured it out in shellfish. There's very sustainable aquaculture for oysters and mussels and clams and scallops, I believe. So we'll figure it out. I mean, we just have to, you know, work on the feed source and figure out, you know, the waste streams and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're working on this deep sea aquaculture, these giant pens for the big fish, the predator fish. And that they are, these pens just kind of float, so you don't have a concentration of waste. They raise some other issues, but I think it's a really important area for investment and, you know, to figure out, because it's potentially a great source of food.
Okay. What is the best advice you can give to encourage the underserved, low-income population who may lack the education or desire to eat fruits and vegetables?
Well, I don't know if I don't accept the premise of that question. From a lot of the evidence I've seen, there is a great demand for fruits and vegetables in the underserved population. I mean, there are these there are these new voucher programs or semi-new voucher programs that if you receive food stamps or WIC, you can, in certain communities, get an additional voucher that is redeemable at the farmer's market.
Oh, yeah.
And these were some pilot programs set up by the USDA, very, very tiny. But then a private foundation on the East Coast called the Wholesome Way Foundation has been going into communities. And there's one in the South Bay. I don't know exactly if it's East Palo Alto or where they're doing it. And they offer people these vouchers. And a student of mine is writing about this, and she went down to San Diego in an underserved neighborhood there, and people were waiting online for hours to spend $3 at the farmer's market.
Wow.
They wanted the fresh produce, and this gave them an entree to the market. And what the effect of these vouchers is, it brings markets in to underserved areas.
Right.
And what invariably happens, too, is that the farmers give people with these vouchers a very good count.
Yeah.
On you know how much food they get, or they start bringing in a second grade, a harvest grade, as opposed to their most pristine heirloom tomatoes, and so there is demand. There is just not access, and the problem is you have a lot of food deserts in our cities, especially where there is plenty of convenience food. And no supermarkets. And the supermarkets have stayed out. There are programs, though, to draw supermarkets in. They're doing this in New York, and they're offering zoning benefits to supermarkets. If you have so many, you know, square feet of fresh produce area, you get some kind of break on your zoning permit. And so there's a lot of work being done to improve access, and it's a really important thing to work on. And then you have urban agriculture, which is... You know, one of the most exciting things going on right now is the kind of farming going on in Detroit and Milwaukee and in some really blighted neighborhoods where people are planting gardens and vertical farms and finding that, you know, there is a powerful local market for this food.
Wow. That voucher program sounds terrific.
Yeah, it's a great program. And hopefully the now that we have a spending freeze, I guess you won't see any more of it. But it was in this USDA budget. It was supposed to be. So hopefully it'll be in the budget announced next month.
Okay. We have time for about one more question. So,
make it a good one.
Yeah, I guess. I'm wondering how optimistic you are that we might see the kind of shift that will move us away from the Western diet and towards something that's better for us and better for the environment. And even if you're not optimistic, what would it take to get us there?
Well, I am optimistic. I don't think we'll get all the way there, but I think we're moving. I think we're moving in a really positive direction. I think that there is a recognition, in no small part, on the part of the health insurers and the healthcare industry, that this is not a sustainable situation. That you know we are spending so much money on healthcare, and so much of it is going to treat these chronic diseases. And that we're in kind of a feedback loop. I mean, we didn't really understand the problem this diet was creating till recently.
Right.
And this happens. You know, societies try things, and sometimes they don't work. And this is something that isn't working. You know, when we look at the Western diet and the kind of industrial agriculture that creates it, we say it's unsustainable. And that means something very specific. It doesn't just mean we don't like it. It means that there's some kind of internal contradiction or it's destroying conditions it needs to survive. And I think that that is true in this case. We can't afford to keep eating this way, and we don't have the fossil fuel to keep growing food this way.
Right.
So that I think change will come. In the same way, we're going to have to simply figure out how to run an industrial civilization without lots of fossil fuel. We're going to have to figure out another way to feed ourselves and another way to grow food. So I think change will come. I think it will be forced on us in one way or another. But hopefully we'll move before we have any kind of serious problem in this food system. So I look forward to a day when, I don't think McDonald's is going away. I don't think the supermarket is going away. I asked a farmer, Joel Salatin, the farmer I profiled in Omnivore's Dilemma. I said, "So is this a revolution?" And he said, "No, I think of it as more of a reformation."
Uh-huh.
And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, once upon a time, if you were a Christian," and he's an evangelical Christian, "there was only one church, and that was the Church of Industrial Food, and that you had to go through those doors to eat. And then Luther came along, and he nailed his 99 Theses up on the Wittenberg, or I forget where he did it, and I actually got it wrong in the book, and
that hurts.
And suddenly you had all these other denominations popping up. And there were many other ways to be a Christian. And the, you know, the Catholic Church never went away, but it got smaller and these other ones got bigger.
Uh-huh.
And we had choice. And I think that's where we're getting. And I think that that's a very reasonable goal. And I think we can get there.
Well, good. I think that's a pretty optimistic note to end on. So I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program and look forward to seeing you at future Silicon Valley 2010 events. Again, we'd like to thank tonight's guest, Michael Pollan, author of this year's Silicon Valley Reads selection, In Defense of Food and the Eater's Manifesto, as well as our moderator, Mike Cassidy, columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. We thank our sponsors and for all of you joining us.
Sounds pretty.